Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. You know, I love talking to authors because they have the courage to take their thoughts, maybe some lessons they've learned, their stories, put it down on a piece of paper, and, you know, share it with the many, and ultimately leading to a different destiny, changing their legacy, and maybe impacting the world itself. So if you're looking to write a book out there, we recommend checking out Dream Starters Publishing. We can help you out with wherever you're at in the process. And if you have a book you want to generate leads with it, check out bookmarketingcrm.com. Now, this podcast is perfect for you out there who loves true stories, all right? I love history. I love true stories. The more we understand it, the more we understand maybe the future of what lays ahead. And maybe we can make adjustments and maybe, you know, produce some type of financial freedom as a result. The book that we're talking about today is called Money for Nothing. It makes me think of a ZZ Top song. And that's probably where you get it from. Or no, Dire Straits. I'm sorry. Dire Straits, Money for Nothing. And the subtitle is The Scientists, Fraudsters, and Corrupt Politicians Who Reinvented Money, Panicked a Nation, and Made the World Rich. So it is an honor to have Tom Levinson with us. Thanks so much for being here, sir.
It's my pleasure.
Well, I will tell you, man, I'm a history buff. I do love, you know, even the documentaries, The Men Who Built America. Somehow, some way, they forgot to mention what happened in 1719. So can you go back and maybe give us a little bit of a pathway of who you were and maybe how you got to where you're at now and maybe why you wrote this book?
I'm a magpie. I look around and I see something shiny and I go after it. And I do that again and again and again.
You're an entrepreneur. All right.
There you go. The shiny stuff I've tended to go after are interesting stories and often interesting history stories. So that's landed me at a pretty good job at MIT, where I am a professor and I teach science writing and science filmmaking. And it's landed me on a series of, you know, just fascinating looks back at really how modern science changed the world. And what's the connection between science and money? Well, back when the scientific revolution was happening, the financial revolution was also happening, a fundamental way that the world changed, you know, starting in England and Britain and spreading all around the world, changing in how they understood what money was and what it can do. And the fact that they are happening at the same time isn't a coincidence, because the same ideas obtained for both and some of the same people were doing work in both domains. And, you know, how I got here, how I got to this book, Money for Nothing, been fascinated for a long time with Isaac Newton, you know, the great founder of modern physics, one of the greatest mathematicians of all time.
Yep.
Alchemist, all kinds of, you know, somewhat wacky religious thinker, all kinds of different things. But also, much less known, a man who was very serious in his thinking about money, the changes in money over time, and even being a, you know, fairly high-level government bureaucrat running part of England's monetary system. So my interest in Newton led me to, you know, what he did in the world of money, and that led me to the fact that he lost his shirt in the first big stock market bubble and fraud, the South Sea bubble, which is really where, it's not the only thing that Money for Nothing is about, but it's where what the book centers on. And that was something that sort of started the sort of preliminary steps that led to the bubble started happening in 1719. As you say, the bubble blew up in 1720, collapsed in the last part of 1720, and Newton was left to wonder why he, along with thousands of others, were suddenly not nearly as rich as they had been before. Hmm. Interesting, you know, so stock market crashes and frauds and all those things make great true stories, right? But what's really interesting about this story, and where I spent a lot of the book thinking about building it up and then trying to figure out what had actually happened, is that despite the fact that there was this huge crash, this huge stock market plunge, lots of, you know, the richest man in England at the time lost his fortune and eventually his life trying to recover that fortune, Duke of Portland. What's really striking about all that is England prospered. Britain prospered. Britain figured out something fundamental about how money works and used it, I think, arguably to become what it would over the next century and a half, the greatest empire the world has ever seen. So that's the short story.
Got it. Okay. So Britain was broke at this time in 1720, though, right? Because they were, didn't they face so many different countries all at once or in consecutive order? Therefore, they were broke and they were struggling. And maybe that was how it was so ripe for us to actually beat these individuals, right? In the war, which is not too far off from this. So is that right around the same time frame? Am I right about that?
The sort of tension that led to war and revolution with the American colonies was building across this entire period. And monetary issues were very much part of it. So, the first paper money in the English speaking world wasn't in London, wasn't coming from the Bank of England, was actually in Massachusetts, where I'm sitting right now, where they printed money to help print paper money, up to that point, the only real money was, silver, gold coins.
Wow. So I didn't even know that. The first printed money was in Massachusetts. That's amazing.
First English world printed money. The Chinese printed money hundreds of years before, and there were other examples. But Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, or at that point, I guess it was, I think the Massachusetts Bay Colony, it changed names so many times. And there was a military campaign against Canada. French Canada, and you got to pay for your soldiers and buy their bullets and food and so forth, and that takes money. And so Massachusetts didn't have any spare coins, so they printed these 1 shilling pieces of paper and used that as a means of exchange and a store of value. Classic things that money does. Britain followed a year or two later with the first Bank of England notes, and for the same reason. Britain was fighting wars that it couldn't afford. It certainly couldn't afford with its supply of metal money. And not only did they print money, which helped increase the velocity of money through the economy, and people spent, you would spend money and then somebody would spend it again and so forth, so you could circulate more easily. But the real reason that Britain needed paper money is it was running out of silver coin. Silver was the fundamental unit of exchange in Britain at the time. The legal currency with which you could pay your taxes. Gold coins existed and they had denominations, but it was silver that was the basis of the money supply at that point. Mm-hmm. And because of a fixed weight of silver that was required for British coins, they actually got the exchange rate wrong. So they could take British silver into France or Amsterdam in the Netherlands, buy gold, bring the gold back to England and have slightly more value in the gold than the silver melted down represented. And it could keep this going as a perpetual money machine, which meant the silver just kept flowing out of England. So they were running out of just actual daily cash. And so they needed substitutes for it. And they used, first they invented paper money, then they invented a whole bestiary of other things, including some of the most sort of spectacular experiments in credit. In sort of selling promises of one sort or another into the future from the government to an investor to raise funds to pay for, again, a war that without that, England couldn't afford. And this kept going on and on. England, Winston Churchill, I think, was the first. I may have this wrong, but there's this idea of the long century of world war that begins in 1689 and goes on to 1815. So it's, the long 18th century. England was at war for most of that time, not absolutely every year, but it was fighting somebody for, the Spanish, the French, the Dutch. There were lots of people that they could get into arguments with, get into beefs with. There was a war from 1689 to 1698. There was a brief period of peace. Then there was another war. Then there was a brief period of peace. And then there was Queen Anne, it just kept going on. You got the War of Spanish Succession. You got the War of Austrian Succession. You had the French and Indian War. You had the War of Jenkins' Ear. You had, and so on and on and on. You had all these wars. And they all cost money. And Britain needed to raise the money. So they started borrowing money and issuing, sort of in a general category, there were bonds. But they had all kinds of weird characteristics. For example, there were bonds in perpetuity. The government couldn't raise enough money and buy them back. They just had to keep paying out the interest year after year. There were bonds for three lives. So I would buy a bond. Then my son would, you know, then it would keep paying off during my son's lifetime and keep paying off during his child's lifetime. That would be a bond for three lives.
Oh, my God. What year was that? When did I have never heard of a bond for three lives. That is an amazing even.
It's just, solution. You know, people didn't understand credit markets at that point. They were just making them. They were making it up as they went.
Yeah.
So they tried all kinds of things. You know, there was this, what was it called? The Daughters of Geneva. There was this French thing. You'd set up a bond based on the survival of a group of girls who lived in Geneva. And they were usually Catholic girls of good family. They would be quite young, and you would get a pool of them and you would insure them, in effect. And the thing would, draw money in perpetuity, or not in perpetuity, draw money until the last one died. So if you played it right, you could run this out for a very long time. And these were, you know, governments would sort of offer something like this. You know, often these were bonds where you never got the principal paid back, but you got the interest rate, the interest agreed on it for some extended period of time. Sometimes they were short-term bonds that could be paid off. You know, they tried everything they could think of. They had lottery tickets. So you would buy a ticket for, say, £10, and there would be a drawing, and you had a chance to win £1,000. And then the ticket would convert, win or lose, it would convert into an annuity that would pay, you know, 4%, 5%, 6% a year forever. And in some cases, they were actually legal tender as well. You could use this £10 ticket as a £10 note. Most people didn't like it. Most people didn't want to accept these because, you know, who knows if the government would honor them. You know, you go back to the government and say, give me my £10. They will say, well, or give me my, you know, 60 pence a year interest or whatever it might be. So people were reluctant to take them at face value. So the government, in one case, the malt lottery bond of the 1698, I think, they actually just forced it on the people who couldn't refuse it, sailors in the Royal Navy who had to take these things as pay. So, you know, and all this was just to try and keep capital coming in to fund government operations in peacetime a bit, but in wartime, which it was most of the time, when it was, you know, enormously expensive to just, you know, equip the ships of the Royal Navy and send regiments across to continental Europe or out to the Americas with all the stuff you need to keep a person alive to aim the guns and fire the bullets, right? So what this meant is that between the late 1680s and the late 17-teens, Great Britain accumulated this enormous mountain of debt to the point where 60-70% of the annual revenue, some enormous percentage, more than half of annual revenue in peacetime went to servicing the debt.
Crazy.
So it's unsustainable. And the thing that would happen is, you know, the government would have, you know what happens? Your business goes bad. You need a loan today to make payroll tomorrow.
Right.
What kind of interest rate are you going to get?
Hey, never borrow money when you need it. That's a message that I've heard many, many, many times.
Exactly.
But when you do need it, you are paying through the roof up to your eyeballs.
Yep. And that was the fate of the British government. So private businesses, private, landed gentry who wanted to buy more land, people involved in, trading businesses, merchant trading or whatever, could borrow money at a pretty stable rate, usually under 5%, often around 3-3.5% throughout this whole period. Government was buying, 6-10%, sometimes more, because they would have to borrow, of course, at the point of, oh my God, we're looking in the king's sofa cushions to get the last coin out to pay somebody. So you get to the, mid and late 17 teens, and it's becoming obvious to those leading the British government that this was just unsustainable. You couldn't keep ratcheting up this debt. You couldn't keep on being a country with, global ambitions. The government had to be at least as well funded as its, increasingly successful trading and private sector. And that meant they needed to come up with a new way to think about both sort of daily money, just how you buy and sell. I need my, loaf of bread today. I need a shilling in hand or sixpence in hand to buy it. You have to have a money supply. But also how to arrange so that the government gets the money it needs to run its operations, both in regular times and in emergencies, at an interest rate that is no higher than anybody else has to pay, and in a way that can be done reliably. You can just go to the capital market and get the money you need whenever you need it. You know, that's the modern, you know, that's the 21st century bond market. That's been most of the 20th century's bond market. It didn't exist back then. You know, the Bank of England was only founded in like 1693 and really started its operations in 1694. There were a handful of small private banks that were in operation for a few years before that. But basically, you know, the financial sector was much more informal than you think. People offering credit individually and keeping tallies. Bills of exchange existed. You know, there are these individual solutions, but no full-on, really well-organized, liquid, understood bond market. And that's essentially what they tried to create in response to this problem. They made a major, they did their first experiment of this in the beginning of the decade of the teens. They did their big experiment that set up what was to come in 1719. And then in 1720, they said, okay, we're going to convert all of the British government debt into shares in a private company that had a monopoly of trade with the Spanish colonies of the Americas, had rights to do things like whaling, and had a unique contract to trade slaves from Africa into the New World. Those were its businesses. And the idea was a person who held a debt that would pay, you know, 7% forever would be willing to trade their stock in for this equity because they'd get a smaller interest payment, you know, around the 3% or whatever it is that that the sort of private market was offering at that point. But they would also share in this company that had this wonderful trading future. They would be able to, you know, they were losing certainty over time, but they were gaining the chance of capital appreciation. And most importantly, they were able to get turn their investments liquid. Because if you held a bond, all you could get from that bond was that 6% or 8% per year. You never had access to the principal. Say you wanted, you know, to buy yourself, you know, a nice new country house or a coach and four or, you know, a riotous night on the town, whatever it might be. You couldn't do that with the holding you had, the asset you had, because it was just an annuity, something that paid paid its whatever its return over time. And now if you traded it, if you turned it into stock in a private company, you can trade it on the then also very new secondary stock market. You can just go down to, Exchange Alley and find yourself a stockbroker or a stock trader, stock jobber, they were called, and say, I got this, lottery ticket. I've got this, government, annuity in perpetuity. I've got this out of the other thing, whatever it may be. Turn it into money for me, sell it to somebody. So those were advantages for the investor. That was the premise. And the idea was this company, the South Sea Company, it was called, picked up in his first experiment in 1719, picked up about £1 million worth of a specific tranche of government debt and exchanged it for shares. And it seemed to work. Everybody was happy. The stock was stable or went up a little bit. And the sale went smoothly and there were no seeming disruptions. And that was when all the fun started.
So while you were speaking, we talk about this bubble that was being created. In my opinion, the first bubble that ever really happened was tulip mania. Am I right? Was in the 1637, right. I believe. So
that was a commodity bubble.
Okay.
It's quite familiar. This is the first, you can argue it, the first, this is arguably the first financial bubble where there was an underlying material asset that was being traded.
And so Newton, okay, when I'm looking at this, by the way, your subtitle is very interesting. And the reason why is because it all sounds like the scientists, fraudsters, and corrupt politicians who reinvented money, panicked the nation, all bad, bad, bad. And then you have the last part. And made the world rich, right? So are you telling me that there's obviously a lot of good that comes out of these times, but are you saying there was so much corruption that there were certain things that they did the right way to obviously create the, I mean, the greatest country the world has ever seen 50 years later. Yeah, 50 years later, you have Adam Smith come out of the woodwork, start talking about the wealth of nations. Maybe it woke a lot of people up, basically, almost like 2020, where all the corruption, all the scamming wakes enough people up where they right the ship, maybe in their own lives and maybe in the country slash companies that they're a part of. So Newton, is he's caught up in this. He's part of this. He got into it, right?
He is part of it in two ways. What, you know, think about what credit is, right? What, you know,
credit, there's enough belief in me that I will pay it back with interest, right? That's it.
Right. So, and if you want to set a price for a bond or a stock for that matter, I mean, after all, a share of in a company, in one definition, is you're purchasing a set percentage, whatever. If there are 100 shares in a company and you buy one, you have 1% of that company's, you have the rights to 1% of that company's future profit stream, right? I mean, you can see a share as just, you know, actual ownership of the company and its book value, its physical plant and so forth. But you can also think of it as just, this is buying you something that occurs over the future. And, you know, I'm willing to pay $100 to get a return of 6% per year, hopefully compounding. That's, you know, kind of the low end of the average of the stock market over the last 100 years, might be a little higher. So you figure out what is the value to you of 30 years of 6% interest, right? And you figure out how much that's worth to you, and you say, okay, I'll pay $100 now to get $6 a year for, or I'll pay $500, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And if the interest rate goes up to 8%, you can pay less because you'll still get your return. And if it goes down to 3%, or you will pay more to get the 8% if you
bingo, of course, yeah.
Yeah. And if it only is 3%, you'll pay less because you're getting less from your money. So if the bond, and switching back to bond has a face value of $100 and it's sold at a 3% coupon, and we're going to just pay 3% year after year after year. And you say, okay, $100 is too much for a 3% return. I need more than $3 a year to rent my money. So I'll only pay you $80 for that thing with face value, right? That's not an obvious concept, right? It's still kind of hard to explain it to people.
Yeah.
People, you know, you
financial literacy is at an all-time low, in my opinion. Right. But back then, I mean,
there wasn't any finance yet. They were inventing, you know.
They were making it up. Yeah, that's right.
So, and the same thing was happening with some basic physical concept. When Newton invented his system of dynamics, the laws of motion and the law of gravity, he had to invent or sortly at least come up with working ideas about concepts like inertia and force and all these kinds of things. He was making it up as he was going along. And, you know, there was this huge sort of conceptual change in the way the world was understood. And one of the things that's common between science and finance and in Newton's life occurred, within his own mind, is the idea that there is a mathematics that precisely describes change over time. And you can use those mathematics to do things like value. And Newton didn't invent this. This was invented a little earlier in the century, but he certainly used it. The concept of present value. $100 in 10 years is worth how many dollars today? You discount it by inflation and by risk, right?
Right.
So you wouldn't pay $100 now to have $100 given to you in 10 years' time, right?
No.
You pay some number lower than that.
Right.
And there's a mathematical way to figure that out, you know, to specify certain assumptions and then sort of go, okay, I should pay $70 for this or $30 or whatever it may be. The number doesn't matter. The fact is there's a way to figure that out. And this was happening around Newton. Newton used exactly that kind of calculation, for example, when he helped his college, Trinity College at Cambridge, figure out how much it should be charging for rents on lands it owned. Used exactly that kind of mathematics. He used similar mathematics to help his friends figure out the right bets, the odds to do on certain games of dice. There was an exchange of letters between him and the famous diarist Samuel Pepys, who was no mathematician at all. And Newton helped him out figuring out basically how to get out of a bet because he made the bet. He made the wrong bet. So he used Newton's calculations, just welsh on what he owed. You know, the the calculator isn't responsible for the person who uses the calculation, right? But the critical idea was that over the course of the last half of the 17th century, Newton and others figured out how to turn change over time into a mathematical problem. So that's obviously important. It tells you if you fire a cannonball, you can calculate the change in its position over time and figure out where it's going to land, right? So that's important for if you're fighting wars. You can figure out how, you know, what the mathematics that governs the fall of an apple and hence the path of the moon. That's change over time, and there's a mathematical way to calculate that out. Newton was the first to systematically express that. But Newton, a bit, and others much more completely, started applying these same ideas to money. And that's the basis of a sort of rigorous, it's the beginnings of a rigorous understanding of credit. If I want money now, and you have it, and that money is going to do something for me such that there is a reasonable expectation I can give you your money back, what should the terms of that in some future date, what are the terms of that exchange? How much do I need to promise you in the future to get your money now? How much, if I'm lending the money, should I expect? How risky is it? How do I calculate that risk? And how easy is it to do this? How flexible and fluid the market is.
Right. And the ease of access, right? That's why credit cards are able to do the 20%. Why? Because anybody pretty much has access to it starting at 18 years old, and you can use it without question at right away. And so the ease of access is part of it.
So, and you know, it's also why kids, if you're getting your first credit card, look really carefully. Not all of them charge 20%. You can find ones that charge less and use those.
Yeah, right.
That's your PSA.
Right.
But that, you know, and of course it's true if you're a CFO of a new company trying to figure out how to finance. Do not don't finance anything that you don't think can provide some reasonable return over time.
Real quick, I'm going to jump in there. I just interviewed an engineer / scientist the other day. And I was talking to him about how I've always, maybe not always, but since, you know, 10 years since I've read Rich Dad Poor Dad, I've looked at money as energy. And he's like, oh, well, it is. Here's why. And he broke it down basically. And I mean, I look at Newton's laws and physics and all that, and I apply it to business. But he said the two laws when it comes to Newton, and this really equates with what you're saying, right? Energy cannot be created or destroyed, but whenever it does transfer, it goes to a lesser quality, right? There is it's the exact same maybe quantity, but the quality decreases. And if you think about that monetary terms, anytime you print money and maybe you have some type of transfer of energy or money's transfer from one person to the next, I would have to say that, you know, due to inflation and maybe even when it comes to costs associated with it, there is a change in quality, right? There's something that transforms. There's a little bit of a difference. And
I'm not sure I agree with that. I'm not sure I agree with your engineer, and I'm not sure I agree with you on that.
So explain that. So explain what you're saying, because Newton's law, though, he says that the quality changes transfusion or any type of energy transfer, matter the quantity changes.
That's
the first time I ever heard it, but I'm like, ooh, that makes sense. So tell me about it.
It's derived from some Newtonian thinking, but it wasn't actually Newton who worked that out. That's a 19th century concept. It comes from thermodynamics. You've heard of the first three laws of thermodynamics?
Yeah, of course.
You can't win, you can't break even, you can't leave the game. So energy is, you can't win. You can't get more energy out of a system than went into it. You can't break even. Every time you do some work, energy goes from a more ordered to less ordered form, right? And there is there's nothing you can do in the world that doesn't require the use of energy. And so you can't leave the game. What's interesting about credit, but, you know, and those laws are really important. The second law, you can't break even, is what you were referring to. It's the underpinning of the idea of entropy. So the energy always moves from a more ordered to a less ordered state. You know, you send some electricity through a wire and you drive an electric motor, but you lose some energy as heat, which is less ordered, less able, and by that, less able to do work, less able to move something.
Mm-hmm.
Simply. But let's say, you know, but you and I sitting here are local reversals of entropy. We will eventually become more disordered when we die, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but right now, we are able to keep consuming energy and keep, you know, having, you know, we can eat a hamburger and produce thoughts. We can write a book based on the energy that we get from our hamburger. Arguably, that's a more ordered state. That's a, you know, there's more information. One of the ways to think about entropy is it's a measure of information flow and information loss. Locally, we have much more energy, much more information available in our bodies and daily life than what will happen when, sadly, you and I are both no longer here. But you can see that in the economy as well. Say I'm hungry. Say I want a hamburger, but I don't want to make it myself. I go to a restaurant. I pay. It's a kind of fancy bar and grill. And I have a nice craft beer, and I have one of those big sort of pub, you know, tavern hamburgers, and I may end up paying, you know, $30 or so. If I'm a good tipper, I'll tip, you know, $6 or $8 to make sure my server is happy. So I put out $35-$40. And that's money that's gone from me to whatever system it was that, you know, ended up with a hamburger and a beer on my plate, on my table. Is the money that I have transferred more or less quality than it was when it was in my pocket?
I would say it's the exact same. The quality, right? The quality. Yeah. Yeah. So I would say the exact same.
Maybe even more. Let's say the restaurant owner uses his shit. You know, you got to pay the server and you got to pay for the beef and all that. So the restaurant owner uses, first of all $40 of that before he pays out for all those things, because there might be a little bit of delay. And he puts it in a little overnight account and makes a tiny fraction of interest. Or let's say he uses that money in the bank account to allow him to borrow more money on a line of credit and open a second location, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Money does funny things when it moves through the world. Money sitting in my pocket is actually fairly low quality. Money moving through the world has all kinds of possibilities.
It bingo. And that's another aspect of it. Money in motion is actually more beneficial than money stagnant, right? Basically, right. If it's in motion, it, once again, another laws of physics, object in motion stays in motion. Usually money that's moving creates more money, right?
Right. So, especially, you know, I put $40 in the bank because I'm just this restaurant owner and I've gotten that $40 check. The bank can then lend out, you know, another $35 or whatever the reserve requirement is. So not only is my $40 there, somebody else has $30 or so to, you know, do something else. You know, and it's, you know, this can, you actually, spending money creates larger credit flows through an economy. And this is, you know, we're jumping ahead. What makes the world rich? Britain was the first nation, as a, you know, officially the government, to figure out that they could do that.
Well,
and they create, you know. Okay.
Real quick. And the reason why I never understood how it changes from quality, but the way I'm looking at this, if I hold a dollar bill right now, and it's a dollar bill today, and I'm holding it the same dollar bill, I was looking for it. I actually left my wallet in the room, but in the tomorrow, the same dollar bill, is it the exact same quality? Is it the same? Does it have the buying power that it once did today? And the true answer is no. It does decrease in quality because the dollar's decreasing due to inflation. So what's the variable? Time, right? And yeah, so as it travels through time, it actually decreases in quality. And as soon as you said it, it makes so much sense.
But that dollar, you know, yes, if you just stick it in your pocket and forget about it, but if that dollar is moving through the economy, that dollar 10 days from now will be worth, you know, a tiny bit less. Because of inflation, you know, hopefully a tiny bit less. Hopefully we're not in a hyperinflation.
yeah, right.
Then what you're talking about is really true. Hyperinflation is a different beast, but ordinary inflation, you want a slightly inflationary economy. You don't want, you know, deflation is much, much worse. I mean, that was the Great Depression. Money lost value. It was just, money gained value against real objects. So something that cost a dollar today costs 98 cents tomorrow, costs 96 cents the day after. That's disastrous because there is no reason to invest. Why would you buy a machine today that would produce $100 worth of goods today, but producing the same amount of goods would only make $96 tomorrow, right? You would, deflation kills economic development. Inflation modestly helps fund it. It actually improves, may not improve the quality of the dollar you hang on to, but it improves the overall performance of the economy.
Bingo. That's a very good point. So inflation, technically, at a small level, is very good. Why? Because if I buy this house and it's worth more in a year from now, it's a smart investment. That's what drives the economy. You do not want deflation, right?
Think of that house as both the place you live. This is why you shouldn't think of houses as an investment. You should think of, I'm going to buy this house because that means I have some certainty in my life. As long as I can keep paying the mortgage, nobody can ever throw me out, right? So you buy a house sensibly. You don't buy more houses than you can afford and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, houses should not be thought of, you know, your own dwelling place. I mean, if you're buying real estate and you're investing in real estate, that's diplomatic. But the place you actually go to sleep each night is not first an investment. It is first.
Agreed. I'm with you on this now. Yes.
Yeah. It's a kind of insurance. You might think of it as insurance. It's the guarantee that you'll have a place to sleep tomorrow as well as today. Right. That's how you should think of it. And we're willing to pay some money for insurance. Right. We pay insurance against the unlikely event we'll have a car crash. We pay insurance against the unlikely event I'll break my leg tomorrow and so forth. You know, the temptation is always say, well, I'm fine today, so I'll just buy insurance tomorrow because I won't need it today.
Mm-hmm.
How sure? How absolutely sure are you won't need, you know? The house is, you know, buying a house has some of that quality. But yes, let's say, but a house can also be conceived of as a kind of savings account. And, you know, your own personal bank, you know, you pay a little bit more down the mortgage every month. You own more and more of it. There's a bit of inflation, so the value goes up. If you live in, you know, if you live in the kind of unfortunate times that we do, certainly in my town, where house prices go up beyond, above inflation, it can, at least on paper, make you actually wealthier than you would be just by buying an index fund or what have you. But the crucial thing is, you know, you can get out a home equity line. You can literally use your house as a bank. I'm not saying you should, but let's say you have a line of credit and that lets you send your kids to school. That's a long-term investment in the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you use that line of credit, you know, the kitchen's kind of bad. So you put in a new kitchen that raises the value of the house. Also, hopefully, and again, you should, speaking as, you know, three or four times homeowner that buying through the decades of my life, you do the house renovations you do because you can afford them and you want, that's something you choose to buy that gives you satisfaction for your house. You shouldn't, again, necessarily do it as a kind of financial investment because who knows, maybe in 5 years' time, people won't want, you know, almond colored appliances anymore and you're, you know, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, yeah.
You know, you shouldn't think of this. It's just straight up financial advice. Do not think of houses as investments in the way you think of buying 100 shares of Apple as an investment, right? It's not the same thing. You need a house. You don't need 100 shares of Apple. You need a place to live. And you need to sort of adjust your financial thinking accordingly. But in fact, the reason that a dollar today is not higher quality than a dollar 10 years from now is if that dollar allows you, in essence, access to more money over time. I save that dollar, I can borrow against it, I can spend that borrowing to do something that adds value to my life, whether it's pleasure or cash, whatever it may be, over time. That's a gain, that's not a loss. Even though inflation is taking a little bit of the price value, the exchange value of that dollar away as time passes, the other things that money does actually brings more value in. And in a healthy economy, that happens fairly reliably.
Right. And so I believe what people need to learn is the importance of keeping money in motion, right? So the make your money and save it is actually poor advice. Make your money and then buy a house and that's your greatest investment is poor advice in my opinion, right? So if you have money in motion, once again, Now you have it as it does it once again, it will collect maybe more money as it comes back to you. And as long as you have money in motion, because money to me is kind of worthless unless it's being used for something, right? And so most of us use energy. Right. That's right.
Most of us use it, you know, we need a certain amount of money just for basic things. We need shelter. We need food. We need, you know, shirts on our back, whatever. We need to make sure our kids are healthy and, you know, and there are things that we close to need, like, you know, it helps to be able to take a weekend off, you know, go to the seashore for a weekend, whatever it may be. There are lots of things you know, money doesn't. It's a mistake to think that the only thing your money should be doing is making more money, because you need things in the world. And some of them are absolute necessities. Some of them are things you choose to be involved in. And, you know, and that means that, you know, there are some things like shelter. You want shelter to be a manageable portion of your income. You don't want to be house poor, because that constrains you in just the way you were describing. Your money gets stuck. All your labor gets stuck trying to keep up with, you know, the payments and so forth and so on. But having, you know, having a secure place to stay is vital. You can't do anything else if you don't know where you're going to be, where you and your stuff are going to be in another month, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, I see that with, you know, that transition from when, you know, I spend a lot of time around college students. There's that weird moment when they graduate and all of a sudden they aren't sitting there in their dorm or their student apartment that's pretty reliable, and they have to go out and find a place. And you know, sometimes for you do this sublet for 6 months and another place. It's incredibly stressful and incredibly expensive to do that. So you don't want that. And, you know, people figure, you know, when you're a student and making the transition into adulthood, it's okay. You figure it out and you get it right over time. But, you know, there are things you need to spend your money on, and you should. But you are absolutely right. Money stuck in a mattress doesn't do anyone any good, doesn't do you any good, doesn't do anybody else any good. You can decide that what you like is to earn a salary and then enjoy your life. You like going out for dinner. You like having fancy cocktails. You like going to Mexico City in the wintertime, whatever it may be. And that's a, you know, not necessarily an entrepreneur's choice, but it's not an invalid choice. And that money going through the world, maybe it's not increasing your wealth in any particular direct way, but, you know, it's moving through the world. You know, the bartender who makes you your cocktail gets her salary, gets her tip, and then, you know, uses it to start her own, you know, bottle, you know, can cocktail business and becomes, you know, the dominant entrepreneur of, you know, the hipster economy or whatever it may be. You know, there are lots of ways money can make more money, and it doesn't necessarily have to be immediately for you, for, you know, when you look at it on the economy wide scale. But all these things we're talking about are modern applications of the ideas of credit, the idea that paying a premium in the future to get money today to do something is a benefit to you and creates some kind of value in the economy going forward. Right.
I think that risk and reward are always going to be married. And if anybody says I'm going to do X, Y, and Z without any risk, I'm always a little bit hesitant because
if somebody says I'm going to make 15% return guaranteed with no risk, I'd say, okay, you're the mark.
You're the mark. That's exactly right.
You know, if you don't know who the mark, But the thing about, you know, the sort of taking it back to the book, this whole idea begins around the South Sea bubble.
Unbelievable. I never knew that. That is so crazy.
You know, what happens is 1719, they do this trade and they get people to give £1 million worth of these sort of fixed and illiquid and inflexible annuities. And they turn it in and they get the, you know, shares of stock and they continue to get dividend payments. And they're taking part in this capital growth, potential capital growth, all these, you know, businesses that this chartered corporation is going to, you know, hopefully undertake successfully. So Britain still has, you know, tens and tens and tens of millions more of this, you know, fixed long-term debt that's this incredible burden, plus a huge amount of short-term debt at high interest rates. And the British government really wants to get rid of it. So the South Sea Company leaders and a small group of politicians within the then ruling party of the, you know, the the ministry that runs the country for the king, get together and say, okay, we're going to make an offer to exchange South Sea shares for all the long-term debt. Okay, we're going to make it open so that you can just, anybody can take it and get shares. And then they'll all, you know, all this government debt will be turned into, and what the government got out of it gets turned into this uniform tradable form, South Sea stock. It's, you know, it's not this annuity for 10 years and that annuity for three lives and, you know, all that sort of stuff. It all becomes just a single financial instrument, easily traded, already being traded on the stock market. And they get a guaranteed lower rate of interest. So the interest drops from an average between 6 and 7 to 4, and it's hopefully going to go down for, you know, the idea is it goes down further over time. And finally, the other thing that the government gets is it gets the right to retire debt. If they have a surplus 1 year, they can buy some debt off the market and it goes away. And up to that point, that wasn't the case. You know, if somebody had an annuity, it was their annuity. The government couldn't force them to cash it in. So the government got a good deal out of that, right? The South Sea Company got a good deal because they got this enormous influx of capital that would presumably allow them to do more fun things in trading and selling slaves and, you know, bringing back South American goods or whatever it might be. And, you know, what happened, this isn't the way it started out, but what happened was they got the right to essentially set the price at which they would transfer shares for equity. What the investors who did this were supposed to get was an asset that had both an income stream and the possibility of capital growth over time and the liquidity, the ability to sell their shares back and forth in the market. The problem was, and there are a number of sort of specific things that went wrong in setting up this detail, but the foundational issue is, so if somebody was willing to trade in 1,000 pounds worth of debt, right, and South Sea shares were valued at par at 100 pounds, that would, you know, every 1,000 pounds worth of debt that the company took in would allow them to issue 10 new shares, 1,000 pounds. That's great. If the person who traded stock got all 10 of those shares, or got almost all 10, you know, maybe there's a little commission, whatever. But that's not what happened, because the company won the right in part by bribing half of parliament and a number of people in the king's court, including at least one and maybe both of his mistresses, got the right to trade, to pay for that 1,000 pounds of debt, not in shares at par value, but in shares at market value, or a value they set, loosely based.
Caught that last part, or the value they set. Oh my God.
Yeah. So you can see where this is going, right?
Yeah.
So the South Sea Company, the first time it went out, I think it was at 300 pounds. They valued the shares for exchange at 300 pounds. So they only had to give 3 1/3, or, you know, 3 shares for 900 pounds, right? And they kept the other 6 of those 9 shares they would get to issue for 900. 6 shares just stayed on the company books. If the market price of those shares was in fact 300 pounds, which it very quickly did reach that, the company just got 1,800 pounds richer. Now, I'm throwing these numbers out. The basic idea is they got to keep more as they raised the price at which they would trade their shares for debt. And it eventually got up to 1,000 pounds per share. So you got one, if you traded in 1,000 pounds of debt, you got 1 share, not the 10 that were issued, right? So you can see this enormously increases the paper value of the company. They get to keep all these shares that are worth all this money. What happens when you try and do anything with that? You know, there's no interest rate. You know, you're not going to get, you know, there's no interest payment that can, you know, they have to, would have to come up with, you know, essentially, you know, if you're giving 50 pounds, you know, 5 pounds per share, that's 50 pounds on 1,000, you know, a 1,000 pound share. But if it's 5 pounds, you know, but if you're only getting, you know, it's just you have to create this, you know, you build all these shares, you have all this stuff going out there. You have, you know, if you try and pay an interest rate on it, a dividend, you know, you have to have this economic activity to support it. You have, you know, say you issue another, you know, 100,000 shares, that's 5,000 more pounds, you know, each time. And you have to, you know, that's real money at some point. You have to do the business. And if you can't, if you haven't done that, you've got paper wealth, but you haven't got actual wealth. And this whole thing only holds value as, you know, it's the line goes up.
The moment it starts to go down and they realize they've oversold the shares almost, very much like Bugsy Siegel and with Vegas. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. So what happens is the shares start trading. This exchange of shares for equity starts happening in April. Shares, you know, with a deal, the shares were trading close to par value, or a little bit over 100 pounds at the beginning of the year. As news of the deal goes out, it just kind of ticks up slowly. Gets up over 200 pounds a share. They announce the actual first trade, jumps up over 300. And then between April and June, it rises to just about 1,000 pounds per share. I wasn't making that number up. And so again, as they issue these and people are trading these things back and forth, Isaac Newton, who held old South Sea, you know, this whole deal is great for anybody who held old South Sea shares that they bought for anywhere from, you know, 90 to 110 pounds, which is sort of the price range it traded in for a decade. Roughly, all of a sudden their shares are worth 300, 400, 600,000 pounds. And if they sold, of course, they would get very rich indeed. Newton sold his old stake at around 400 pounds. And then he watched the stock continue to go up. He said, oh my God, all that money I, quote, lost by not keeping my shares. He bought in again at the top of the market.
Oh my God. He's a smart guy too. He got caught in it.
Right. And there were people in London who were calculating how much money would you need to make this investment? You know, what would be the appropriate price for these shares, given what the company can realistically make? You know, they were getting an interest payment from the government for the debt that they took in. That was much lower than the previous rates had been. And they had you know, the possible success of their trading business. That was their only source of income. And so people would calculate the future value of this. They'd calculate the interest rate. They would calculate what the price of the share ought to be given that predictable income. And it was always much, much lower than what was at each point in the bubble. It was much lower than what it was actually trading for. You know, it was trading for 400. The actual share price should have been, based on this present value calculation, about 160 pounds. And, you know, it went up a little bit as the share price went up much more. So it never made sort of investment analysis sense. Hmm. Never. Of all people in the world at that time, Isaac Newton could do that mathematics. There was nothing different. You know, he could do it in his sleep. You know, he was by far the best mathematician in the world at that time, certainly the best mathematician in England. There was no reason he couldn't figure this out. But his is a case showing how the emotion of the financial market can overtake even the most brilliant mind. Because it's certainly captured.
Amazing, right?
People and he lost a ton. He lost in 1720 terms, he lost 20,000 pounds. For comparison, that's like 32 million pounds today. That's real money. Right, that's a big chunk of change, and he was fortunate that he had some other investments. He didn't lose all his wealth. He stayed comfortable the rest of his life, but he lost a ton, and so did lots of other people. So that's really bad, right? You know, it makes people think, oh, the stock market's, you know, just a sinful gambler's game. It's not, you know, all this sort of stuff. It's terrible, except that in the wake of the bubble. The man who became the first sort of true prime minister of Britain, the first person to really consolidate power in a single office like that, Robert Walpole, and his colleagues figured out that the one important thing was all of Britain's debt had been turned into South Sea stock. It still had all the virtues that sold the deal in the first place, and they were going to keep it. They weren't going to unravel the debt. They weren't going to reverse the trades. The people who lost money just lost. Too bad. Sucks to be you. But we're going to keep this, and we are going to set up in the future when we raise debt, we're going to raise debt in this way through the financial market, issuing a liquid tradable, easily retired, flexible instrument. And it turned out, essentially, that out of the South Sea bubble came the first modern bond market. And that bond market, which it had and its chief rival, France, did not, allowed Britain, who was one-third the size of France, probably one quarter of its wealth. France was a really rich country. Britain was still able to finance itself so that it could fight toe-to-toe with France for a century. And eventually, when the final defeat of Napoleon in 1815, win that century-long war and become unequivocally the dominant power in Europe. And hence, by that time, with steam and ships and guns and so forth, the dominant power in the world. It's an amazing story.
Oh my God. So I'm looking this guy up. I've never heard of him. Robert Walpole. That's W-A-L-P-O-L-E. I got to look this guy up.
Walpole is amazing. He's one of the most important pivotal figures in the creation of sort of certainly the early modern world. And even in England, which tends to be obsessed about its own history and its own leaders, Walpole has not received the scholarly attention or the biographies. There's one biography from like 30 or 40 years ago that is, pretty comprehensive. He's a really pivotal figure politically and in lots of other ways.
And
he was personally corrupt, and he was a guy who liked food too much. He grew quite fat. He liked ladies too much. He and his wife eventually developed, I think, an arrangement. He was not he was a fun and interesting figure. He wasn't, a moral exemplar. I would have thought there's a lot of rich territory for some good biographer to go to town on him, but so far nobody has, or no recently, certainly.
Kind of makes sense though, that all this, corruption and all this greed, I guess. You're talking about a country that was in such shambles. Maybe it almost needed war to maybe either as a distraction, but also as a way to raise funds or to acquire resources from other countries. All of this stuff makes sense to this day, right? All the shit that we learned back in 1719 can be applied. And what you're saying, though, I think is the great takeaway, is that no matter how smart you are, when you're looking at the market and things are going up, your emotions will get the best of you, and almost it will blind you from many things. So Right. Is there one or two great takeaways that you've learned from doing the research on this?
Certainly. What you just said is one of them. People overreact when the market goes up, and they overreact when the market goes down. Yep. One of the things you have to be very, very careful about is to try and find some way to isolate your feelings from your financial decisions. That's incredibly hard to do. If Isaac Newton couldn't do it, you and I are going to have our problems. So you have to sort of get in ahead of it. It's one of the reasons why people who don't, who don't have the time or effort information access to be an active investor are probably, the whole index fund thing is probably, the right way to go. Don't think it hurts the team, as they said in Bull Durham. Overall, the U.S. economy has been a growth machine for almost all of its history. When you buy an index fund, you're essentially buying the U.S. economy. S&P 500 is most of the stock market. It'll go up, it'll go down, but while past performance is no predictor of future performance, over the history of the United States, and certainly over the last century, the stock market has a pretty consistent record, smooth over time, of growth. You probably have the number in front of you right there. I just kept thinking
the only way to beat the S&P 500 over an extended amount of time is to be a politician, a corrupt politician. Those are the only ones that seem to beat it, right?
Or to be Warren Buffett.
Yeah, right. Those are the two. You're either one of the geniuses of this planet, right, or you're behind the curtain doing insider trading.
Or do what my mom did. Buy like three or four shares of Berkshire Hathaway in the 90s and just never sell them.
Never. Yeah.
You don't have to be Warren Buffett. You just have to recognize Warren Buffett when he walks along.
Finding Steve Jobs. Just find an Apple back in 1984. That's all you got to do.
Oh God. Anyway, but the other great takeaway is, credit is one of, the financial markets are both one of the most extraordinary inventions for human well-being that have ever been created, and are subject to certain kinds of predictable failures that seem to happen over and over again in every generation. We haven't stopped having stock bubbles. We haven't stopped having, you know, frauds that look obvious in hindsight, but people still get sucked into at the time. And, you know, we had the dot-com crash. We then had the subprime mortgage crash, which is, you know, subprime mortgage crash, much more sophisticated mathematics, much more complicated instruments, but basically exactly the same.
Yeah, I was going to say it's the same. You're talking about what the Black Tuesday, is that what they call it? It comes, that's the same type of process, right? Just belief dies. There's a huge demand, a lot of belief, and then it just falls out. Very much like the subprime crisis in 2007, 2008.
And, you know, and periodically in crypto, I mean, the
dot-com boost. Yep.
Yeah, and you know, the bank that I'm blanking on the name of the bank that just failed last year.
FTX, but there was also the bank in California.
That's, you know. Yep. And, you know, I suspect many of your listeners may not like what I'm about to say, but it's really true. We need finance. We need financial markets to have the ability to do things innovatively and flexibly. It was the innovations of 1720 that led to the establishment by about the early 1750 of a genuine full-on government bond market in Britain. And that did an enormous amount of good when those ideas were exported to the nascent United States. After, you know, 1783, when we got our independence, that led to a private financial market where individual private businesses could raise money, led to an enormous industrial and economic boom in the United States over the next 40 years. Very important. And yet they fail in predictable ways. And they fail usually at the point when there are significant innovations and information asymmetries between the people doing the new cool financial thing and the people trading in it. And that means you need a constantly vigilant, flexible, you know, limber financial regulation system. Unregulated finance leads to booms and busts over and over again. And there's this enormous destructive loss of investment and confidence and damage to, you know, huge damage to ordinary people's lives that come from, you know, these busts, some of which at least are clearly preventable with a regulatory system that hasn't been captured by the, you know, by the people who are trying to get rich fast.
You prefaced that very nicely. And the reason why is because, you know, my audience most likely doesn't like the word regulation or regulators, right? Because you hear that and you say, well, who are the people doing the regulation, right? So it's always scary. And my philosophy is this: think like an entrepreneur, take accountability for everything you do in life, realize there's chaos and opportunity everywhere. And if you see the fire, run towards it and figure out how you could serve the world and therefore you could profit from it. Now, one last thing about it is, you know, you see the kids getting the credit cards at 18 years old and you could say, hey, those are really high interest rates out there. It's the regulators that should go in and say less credit card interest rates. Well, technically, if you do it the right way and you're taught financial literacy, you could reap the rewards of getting the credit cards and doing great things with it, but being very aware that those interest rates are there. So look into it. And in independent thinking and financial literacy really protects people. So that's my philosophy. Regulation, oh my God, scares me. You know that.
Well, I'm sure it does. But, you know, you look at what happened. I mean, one of the really interesting things about it is looking at the crypto world, which is, it's not completely unregulated, but it's substantially less regulated than, for example, the conventional banking industry.
Right. Yes. It's getting more and more regulated as time goes on, for sure. Yes.
That's right. Because, you know, two things have happened with crypto. It's been used extensively for criminal purposes, which is a problem.
FTX, when it comes to
FTX was a fraud. But, you know, I mean, one of the big applications of crypto is to do illicit money transfers. So, you know, there's a fair amount of documentation is used to facilitate sex trafficking and drug trading and all that sort of stuff. That's what, you know, that's why there isn't any Silk Road anymore. Silk Road was shut down because it was shown to do too much of that. But, you know, the problem with crypto is, there are lots of issues with crypto. I think of them as problems other people might not. But among them are the fact that the there is no underlying trading rule. There are no in advance regulations on, for example, you know, issuing a non-liquid, I'm getting way out of my competence here, so I don't want to go into too many details. But one of the consequences of a, I'm also, not only am I out of my competence, I'm struggling to remember various you know, terms for different aspects of the crypto world. But you can observe throughout the last 5 years of crypto, this periodic boom and bust cycle in which thinly traded markets that are governed that are dominated by a relatively few large investors are able to sort of repeatedly drive and profit from different cycles of market behavior.
Yeah, very few can control many is what you're saying. And yeah, I see that, yes.
Yeah, and much of that kind of trading is prohibited in the, you know, sort of above ground stock market and financial markets and is not in crypto.
Would you say that sounds very centralized in your opinion? Very few affecting many, right? So I look at.
If you want to get into the rhetoric and ideology of crypto, yes, crypto says we're this democratic, transparent, everybody can see the transactions and so forth and so on. But you will notice that lots and lots of crypto seems to be contained within a relatively small number of institutions and a relatively small number of really big financial actors. So,
sounds like the Federal Reserve to me, what you're just saying.
You really want central banks. That was the other thing that happened in the 1680s to 1790s was the creation of what evolved into the first central bank with the Bank of England.
Well, I'm not a big fan at all of Federal Reserve and central banks. And I look at anything that's centralized is bad, right? That's why I look at it. It just opens the door for much, much, much more corruption than you can ever handle. That's the way I look at it.
I have worked for Fortune 500 companies, and I worked as my own business owner. I had a small television production company, and now I work at a big nonprofit institution, a university. And the hideous truth is, I saw a ton of corruption in Fortune 500 business practice.
Oh, I'm with you. I think they're very well connected to the government. That's why.
No. I mean, it's just there's you don't need to be connected to government to be corrupt. There are lots.
Of course, right.
there are lots and lots of ways to do it. I think the common element is not. I actually think the government is significantly less corrupt. Certainly, the bureaucracy is significantly less corrupt than a fair amount of our private sector.
Tom, we got to sit you down and set you straight here because Nancy Pelosi is worth $290 million. All right. Her salary has only been $180,000 at the very highest point.
Uchi Mary, and she's from a rich family. You know, the best way to get rich.
Is to be born rich.
Exactly. You've got to pick the right parents and then you'll be rich. you see this acutely in places like England where the same handful of families own most of the land and have for generations, starting, of course, with the royal family, which owns, I think the royal family is the largest individual landowner, but anyway, that doesn't matter. But Nancy Pelosi, a lot of Nancy Pelosi's net worth comes from inherited wealth and its growth over time.
No. It's a small percentage. She doesn't come from that much money, that family.
She and Paul Pelosi. Anyway, we can argue about that. But
Paul Pelosi is an investor, right? Yeah. And by the way, if you look at their portfolio, they're better than Warren Buffett. You tell me that there is not corruption. Anyway, these are the people that we're giving them more power by giving them more authority if we give them the ability to regulate our cryptocurrency.
Crazy. The other thing I'm going to say that your viewers or listeners will hate is that this is why you want really good civil service bureaucracies that are insulated from political actors, because it turns out that a good civil service is one of the best ways to assure uncorrupt. And good civil services with a really powerful inspector general service. Again, I don't think you guys are going to agree with it. But, you know, look at the so let's say every single politician, I think, who is it?
Most are corrupt, except for the people who make their money in the private sector, then enter politics, in my opinion.
even there, I mean, so Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, the richest president, richer than any other president combined. All of the presidents combined, maybe, didn't equate to his wealth, correct?
Maybe, because you got to remember that certainly on his self-reported wealth, he's richer than everybody else. It's not clear that the wealth he reports is the wealth he actually controls.
Forbes just said he's the 497th richest person on the planet, all right?
Yes, but that's still done from public sources that he controls. Anyway, leave that aside for a second. Donald Trump made his money the old-fashioned way, right?
Yes, yes. Well, two ways. He made his money $1 million from his dad. I will say his dad was a great entrepreneur.
When his dad died, he inherited hundreds of millions. And the calculations I have seen are that he would have done better for his total net wealth if he put the entire inheritance in the S&P 500 when his dad died than by opening casinos and having four of them go bankrupt, et cetera, et cetera.
You have to admit he's a genius, though, when it comes to branding. You have to.
Branding, he's very good at. Investment, I think the jury is very much still out, literally in one case. But so Donald Trump is extremely wealthy. I mean, whatever.
Yes. He's wealthy, right?
He's a really rich guy.
Which means he's unbuyable from the political sphere, though. Am I right? He's unbuyable.
No, I think you're clearly wrong. Because look what he did during his presidency.
Yeah, he did great tax cuts. Great tax cuts.
He did tax
cuts. Kept us out of the war. Kept us out of wars. He's the only one, by the way. The only one in the past, eight presidents?
You have really drunk the Kool-Aid, haven't you?
Wait a second. Are you telling me that he started a war? He's the only president in the past eight that didn't get into wars.
Well, Obama didn't get into wars. He just kept fighting the ones that he inherited from Bush. But again, I'll give Trump this. He won't accept the credit for this, but he actually did strike a deal in Afghanistan to end that war.
Yeah,
he absolutely signed a deal with the Taliban, said we will withdraw by X date.
Yeah.
Joe Biden got a ton of grief from Republicans and from the press for following the agreement his predecessor had made and withdrawing us from Afghanistan when he did.
It was how it was done. It has nothing to do with doing it. It's how it was done when we lost lives. You saw the videos. People were hanging
How it was done was what Donald Trump negotiated. He said, we are leaving on this date. What the U.S. High Command wanted, and perhaps to correctly, perhaps not, was to leave a protective force behind.
We didn't lose a guy under Trump, though. We didn't lose one man.
True. No, that's absolutely not true. First, you know, for
13 died on a day that Biden was in. 13, I think. Is it 13? I think it was.
Remember, you don't remember that one of the very first things that Trump did was authorize a mission in Africa that lost the lives of several American servicemen in
Afghanistan. I'm talking about in Afghanistan.
We lost plenty of people in Afghanistan.
Not under Trump. Not under Trump.
I'm sure we did. No. Look, you know, you may have heard that, but that's wrong. I'm going to do U.S. I'm going to do this. You know, we're here. We're doing this. Afghanistan deaths by year. Okay, so
there was 13 in one day for Trump, for Biden.
So 2017, we lost 15 servicemen. 2018, 16. 2019, 23. 2020, 11. Those are the 4 years that Trump was in office. And in 2021, before the withdrawal under Biden, we lost 13, which was below the average per year and above only a single year in Donald Trump's presidency.
What's your source on that? I got to look that up.
This is let me see. This is, so that is from Defense Casualty Analysis Systems, which is a Pentagon. I can even put the, so this is the Defense Casualty Analysis System, conflict views. You know, it's basically a central repository for U.S. casualties in wartime.
I got to look that up, like, because I know that whenever Biden left, they had the funeral and everything for him, right? For all the people who died because of the way he left. And Biden was looking at his watch during the whole funeral ceremony. Do you remember this?
I'm sorry. You've been drinking the Kool-Aid too long.
When
American servicemen died, servicemen and women died, did Trump go to the Dover base and greet the coffins? No, he did not.
I have not seen the people who died over there during his presidency. I didn't see it. But he's the only one that didn't get us into a war. And since Biden, what is it? Putin invades Ukraine within a year that he becomes president.
So question. Is there a single serviceman on the ground in Ukraine? Are we in that war?
Well, No, but how much money has been given? We're a part of that war, whether we realize it or not. There's a proxy war going on.
And you don't think there were proxy wars during Trump? We had troops on the ground throughout Trump's campaign and still do in Syria. There are U.S. troops in Syria under both Trump and Biden.
Do you think the world is safer now or when it was under Trump, in your opinion? We got multiple wars going on. Israel. Gaza, Palestine. Come on. You know the answer. Hang on with me here. You know it, right? Trump.
No. Not even close. And the reason it's not even close is because Trump was, in alliance with, in collaboration with Vladimir Putin. He was, he basically surrendered to North Korea. Gave them meetings that no other president would give them.
That was great, by the way. He saved a war, right? There was no doubt about it. We would have been a war with North Korea. But here's my question. Last question I have for you.
Okay.
All right. If he's in cahoots with Putin, why wouldn't Putin invade when Trump is president? Why would he wait till Trump is left for him to invade? Why would he do that?
Because he doesn't want to destabilize Trump, who is a valuable partner to him. He does want to destabilize the United States. But in fact, you're making a fundamental mistake here. You are assuming that what Russia does is determined by what they want to do to us. There's some part of it there, but Russia and Putin, the war with Ukraine didn't start in 2021. It started in 2014 when Putin took Crimea and then invaded the eastern section of, the so-called Little Green Men, the eastern section of Ukraine. And there's been a constant pressure. There's been a low-grade war. There's been artillery shelling, all that sort of stuff from, the Obama presidency, entirely through the Trump presidency, that then grew into a hot war. Why did this happen? Not because Putin is necessarily fighting a war with the West, though he is. It happened because Putin wants to re-expand the old Russia the new Russia into the old Soviet Union. He wants those territories back. He wants to reconstitute empire. He said this over again. His prime minister has said this. This is on public record. You can go look it up yourself. It's really there. I'm not making this up. And he's doing what he wants. He's doing what he did in Ukraine because he wants Ukraine. If it destabilizes the U.S., so much the better. But he wants Ukraine.
But didn't he make an agreement with them? Hey, listen, as long as Ukraine doesn't become part of NATO, I'm cool with it. And then as soon as Biden gets in, that was an agreement.
Biden didn't invite Ukraine into NATO.
Kamala Harris, as soon as he become president and vice president, Kamala Harris is saying we're going to get Ukraine a part of NATO. It's on record.
But I'm not sure they said that.
Yes, they met with Kamala Harris, met with them right away, right out of the gate. However, I have a podcast, but you got to look this up. So who broke the agreement? It's actually.
Did Ukraine apply for membership in NATO?
No, the conversations happened. I don't know if they applied, but you have Kamala Harris on record saying we're going to help Ukraine become part of NATO. If you were Putin, regardless, you would say, "Wait a second, breaking the record."
I'm really sad to see somebody so smart and so full of energy and so dynamic as yourself so completely fall for Russian propaganda.
My last question. Wait. All right. So me and you, let's just say we're on the highway. We're both buddies. Okay.
Right.
As a buddy, I would say, oh, you know what? You can drive in front of me. You can get in front of me on this highway. So you can if we're in traffic, you can get in front of me. A buddy allows you to go in front without any consequences. Okay. That makes sense. What happened with you're saying that Trump and Putin, because they're buddies, Trump wouldn't just say to Putin, hey, come on in. You can go and do whatever. And I'm going to stop the funding. I won't sign any bills. We're never going to fight you. No, what happened was I'm not going to enter because I'm scared shitless of what Donald Trump would do. And
do you really believe that?
I 100% believe that. Trump is a wild card.
Trump is a coward.
No. Okay. And all right. So what else happens is the moment Trump leaves, they got Biden in there, and Putin is, I will say, a million times smarter than freaking Biden. Right. We know that at least. So.
Oh God. No. We don't. But Biden, you know, one of the most amazing things is
Biden can't even finish a sentence. And I'm not a Putin supporter, but it's pretty obvious.
This is just, I mean, I'm impressed because, you know, I do live in, you live in a bubble, I'm afraid, and I live in a bubble.
You're an honest guy, at least.
You're false on
a lot of things, but you're an honest guy.
I live in this Brookline, Cambridge, liberal academic bubble.
Oh, yeah, I can tell.
You live in this, you know, MAGA, Trump is who he says he is. I won't look at any of the other sources. I'll say stuff that's easily Googledly wrong, like no serviceman died in Afghanistan under Trump. Just not true. We both live in these bubbles. We have information asymmetries between us. And that's a real problem. We can't talk coherently because you are so convinced that Trump is this particular figure. And you believe things about Biden that are, again, easily shown to be not true.
I can watch a speech and I still don't know what he's even saying.
Have you watched one of Trump's speeches lately?
Oh, they're the greatest thing ever. They're awesome. Yeah.
You haven't been worried by the cognitive decline and the verbal mismatches, the inability to remember certain, you know, facts, including like, you know.
You mean to tell me a guy that's under X amount of false indictments from a corrupt president and he's fighting all these people and then he gets in front of us? Have you seen his rallies, though? It's a concert. It's the people love him. They love him.
He's a great showman. I think what's interesting is the rallies have become less frequent and less well attended than they used to be.
That's false. I'm going to tell you right now, they're bigger than ever. Well, he's in court a half the time. When you have a corrupt president indicting him for stupid things about a porn star.
This is the first trial he's been at where he's been required to be in court.
With a gag order. With a gag order. Multiple gag orders.
He's not allowed to dox jurors. That's pretty standard. It's not unique to him.
No, he's not allowed to talk about the case. Biden is lost on his stage. Biden can't find his way off a stage. You have to admit that. You've seen him lost on his stage.
You know, again, I find this, you know, you really want to believe at the same time that Biden is this, you know, incredibly successful Machiavellian figure orchestrating this attack on Trump and
Biden administration. When I say that Biden administration, okay, Biden doesn't even know what day it is. I will say Biden has no clue what day it is.
what's amazing is, you know, you're wrong. If you watch the State of the Union address, just that, and tell me that Biden was either unintelligible or low energy.
I will say that was one of his best showings. And that was a better showing than when I expected.
Okay, so
the bar is set so low. If he remembers his name, I'm like, holy shit, he's doing pretty well. Like, that's the way I look at it.
Because again, we live in this symmetrical bubble. Because I look at Trump and I hear this guy who is, in my view, clearly suffering from the early onset of dementia, which runs in his family. He can't talk. He has these sort of sudden moments when he seems to go into a fugue state and say this, you know, just random stuff. It's really amazing. And, you know, you don't see it. And I think Biden is doing just fine. But I will give you an actual empirical way to think about this.
Okay, let's hear it.
Trump in 4 years, during which for the first 2 years, which he had controlled both houses of Congress, just like Biden did for the first 2 years of his term, got one major bill through, the tax cuts, which benefit only the top of the income stratum. Almost all taxpayers see no benefit from these tax cuts that he was able to get through. He was unable to achieve one of his major priorities, ending Obamacare. Remember, he lost that in one vote because of John McCain.
Yeah, they call him no name. That other guy's a traitor, I believe, to this country. It's a shame.
All right. Again, he was unable to do something that was clearly a high priority for him. He was unable to. He regularly proclaimed infrastructure week, failed to get an infrastructure bill through ever. And then, of course, there's the whole COVID pandemic, which he badly, you know, the amazing thing about the COVID pandemic, this is really great. Trump did one thing that was brilliant, that was genuinely a huge life-saving.
Operation Warp Speed, you're saying?
Yeah. Operation Warp Speed was a great thing.
I think it was a devastation to this world. It's one thing I do not like what he did. So I'm not a big fan of that at all.
Why not?
I will strike that as when you have a vaccine that's untested, giving it to the population, scary, right? Anything across the board like that is scary. So in my opinion, what he did do right was not make it mandatory.
Why do you say it was untested? I'm really curious.
Because it usually takes 4 to 6 years for them to approve a vaccine. They did that in 3 weeks.
I understand the approval sequence, but I'm asking you why you thought it was untested. You know, this is actually something that is that comes closer to my academic specialty. So I kind of know something about this even.
Yeah. So
up to now, you and I have just been two guys shouting at each other across the bar.
I'm not shouting. We're good. We're
of
friends.
Of course, yeah. No. I mean, you know, we're having a good time.
Vaccines. All right. The fastest vaccine in recorded history to get approved, I think, is 4 years. 4 years. Right.
Okay.
They made this. They made it. Found it, and then all of a sudden, 3 or 4 other companies came out together at the exact same time. Come on, something's fishy.
Why is that fishy to you? Because you remember the underlying technology,
mRNA. The guy who created mRNA patents says it's bad for the body. That's what's unique about this.
Right. There's a number of problems with that statement.
I have a podcast in 2 minutes. Hey, could you come back on and after Trump wins in 2024 November? Can you come back on? We got to have a conversation.
I'm pretty sure Trump is going to get badly hammered, but that's not. I mean, he's already been dropping in the polls for the last 2-3 months.
Last time he was winning up until 3 a.m. So he'll probably win up until about 3 a.m. And then all of a sudden those ballots are going to come right in. Maybe you see, you might be right about that, but who knows?
Yeah.
I have to say, you're fun to talk to, even though you're on the wrong side of the tracks. I still like talking to you. You do know a thing or two about when it comes to Newton history and some money. So money for nothing, guys, with the scientists, fraudsters, and corrupt politicians who reinvented money, panicked the nation, and made the corrupt rich or made the world rich. So when I hear that, by the way,
often, but yeah.
when I first heard it, I'm like, that sounds like 2020. Corrupt politicians, fraudsters, scientists. That is 2020 in a nutshell. So amazing timing for this. So anyways,
right. Well, it's been lovely talking to you. I hope you have a good day.
Yeah, great talking with you. And remember, guys, $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life right on.